So we're carrying on our series of metaphors, but it's a little bit of a twist because this is the second of our Song of Songs, a mini-series in the middle of the metaphor series. It's a continuation, but a little bit of a different spin on things. And then next week we'll be carrying on the metaphor series. We're doing a bit of an all-A service next week, but then a metaphor for the next couple of weeks after that with Mark and Vince. But we're carrying on Song of Songs, and I just want to do a bit of a recap in a minute for those people that weren't here, because it is a very complex book. It's a bit hard to understand. It's a very different book from what we read in the Bible already, and so I'll give you a little bit of a background of what are things I said a couple of weeks ago. But you may recall, and some of you may not have heard this story before, it's a fairly classic story in Christian circles, and it's a story of a young woman that is struggling with her faith, and she goes to church inevitably and speaks to a few of her friends at church to gain guidance about things in life that she's struggling with. And one of her friends at church decides that she wants to encourage her. So she writes her a letter, and in this letter she writes down a verse from the Bible, which in commonly known circles, in sort of fairly mad Christian circles, is known as God's telephone number. Jeremiah 33:3. It says, "Call to me and I will answer you and tell you great and unsearchable things you do not know." So a very encouraging message for this young woman. And so she writes some very encouraging words, and then she puts Jeremiah 33:3 at the bottom of the note. Well, you can imagine the surprise of this young woman when she gets the note. She's very excited to receive it. She reads the words and she goes to Jeremiah 33:3. But unfortunately, instead of putting Jeremiah 33:3, the friend hadn't put the right text in and put Jeremiah 3:3. So when the young woman came to look this up in her Bible, she read these words: "Therefore the showers have been withheld and no spring rains have fallen, yet you have the brazen look of a prostitute. You refuse to blush with shame." Now, there's a lesson in there somewhere about how we use the Bible, about how we use the Bible both in terms of writing it down in a very simple verse and chapter, but also how we use the Bible in terms of its interpretation and application. And so when we come to the Song of Songs, we've got to be very cautious and tentative about how we interpret and apply these things, because these are very complex imagery. And I'm just going to recap some of the things we shared a couple of weeks ago before Easter. We know that this is a collection of ancient Israelite love poems, and they are fairly shocking, they're provocative, they're racy, they're intense, they are explicit in places. And they reveal a covenant bond between the beloved, the young woman, and the lover, a young man. And there was a whole series of horticultural and geographical images, and we've had those already this morning, so thank you for setting up this sermon with those horticultural imageries already. And so there's all sorts of metaphors and descriptions of land and gardens that we don't necessarily understand. But it makes a connection between land and horticulture and geography as a radical celebration of the human form, particularly the female form, the female body. And there's also a complex series of voices. There is the beloved, there is the lover, who are speaking in these sort of fantasy, dreamlike sequences. But also there is an audience. The young woman has a series of maidens that she speaks to, and they speak to her. And there's also a sort of ominous background, dark voice of the brothers. It may be family relatives or members that speak words about this relationship that's forming. And there are all sorts of changing senses and shifting moods and dreamlike sequences. It's playful, it's flirtatious, and it's intense. But also, as I've said already, it is quite dark and ominous in places. And there is a sense of division and discord and even violence in a couple of places as well. And we found out that the lovers are protagonists. They are passionate advocates for their love and for their relationship against all of these outside voices that want to shape and censor their love. And so they seem to have opposition against their love and their relationships from these people, the maidens and the brothers. And it may be that this relationship between the beloved and the lover is a cross-cultural relationship, a cross-social relationship between a young black woman of lower social class and a young man of higher, possibly even noble birth. And that may have been one of the reasons why there's this sort of discord and why the lovers are trying to defend their relationship, because it's so out of the norm. And so this love is risky. It clashes with social, cultural and religious prejudices and boundaries. And it also, it shocks us by the language, by the explicit nature of the language and the references to the female form and to the female sexuality and to the act of lovemaking. Another thing that surprises us is the young woman's voice is dominant. 56 voices against 36 voices of the man's voice. And she is a bold, confident advocate of her own love for this young man. She is assertive in her desire to fulfill herself in this relationship, sexually, physically, emotionally, and even spiritually. And it is a man of her choosing that she wants, against all these other voices that are trying to counter that. And so her voice is unprecedented in Scripture. We don't have a voice which is so uncensored and so unmediated in the Bible. And she is a voice of power, the power of love against all the odds. And we see an example of this love being threatened and her identity and her sexuality being censored in one of the passages. If you want to turn with me to Song of Songs and chapter 8 and verse 6. And this is a common series of verses that very often people use in weddings, in wedding sermons. It says, "Place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death, its jealousy unyielding as the grave. It burns like blazing fire, like a mighty flame. Many waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot wash it away. If one were to give all the wealth of his house for love, it would be utterly scorned." Waters there, as we saw a few weeks ago, is deemed to be something of an enemy to the love that is sprouting and growing between this couple. It is a love which is facing opposition, but is unyielding as the grave. It burns. It is fire. It's a seal on arm. And you get the whole idea here that the brother's voice, the maiden's voice, are the waters that are trying to say something against this relationship, trying to censor it, trying to control it, trying to regulate their desire and behaviour. Look down what the friends say. "We have a young sister, and her breasts are not yet grown. What shall we do for our sister for the day she is spoken for? If she is a wall, we will build towers of silver on her. If she is a door, we will enclose her with panels of cedar." Now, these so-called friends, they may be male relatives, they may be the maidens, we're not really fully sure, but they seem to be set themselves up as guardians of her virtue, of her virginity, of her innocence. And they say her breasts are small. That means she's young. She's immature. She needs to be guarded and protected from this young man that's going to take advantage of her. And they say, if she is a wall, that means if she keeps her virtue, we will reward her. If she is a wall, we will build towers of silver on her. She'll be rewarded with something, with silver. But if she is a door, what do you do with a door? What do you do with a door? You open it, yes. So, if she is a door, that means if she opens herself up to the advances of this young man, if she loses her virtue and virginity, then they say ominously, we will enclose her with panels of cedar. The door here in this sense is like a door opening up the enemy. A door, very often in this ancient Israelite period, was a door outside the city walls that protected people coming in and out, and it would be open from the inside. And they're basically saying, if you open yourself up to the enemy, we will confine you. And the words here are aggressive and indignant. They have a threat to them in their tone. There is a sense of which you are young and immature and we've got to look after you. But the young woman's response is typical of her assertiveness. What does she say in verse 10? I am a wall. That means I am virtuous. I have kept my virginity. And my breasts are like towers. What do you think that means? Sorry? I'm grown up. I'm mature, yes. I'm old enough to look after myself, thank you very much. I don't need you butting into my love life. I am old enough and independent enough, physically, mentally, emotionally mature to make a decision about my love for this young man. I don't need you to tell me what to do. And she goes on then to say, thus I have become in his eyes like one bringing contentment. And she goes on to talk about, in verse 12, but my own vineyard is mine to give. And we know that vineyard, in this sense, means garden, means her sexuality, means her body, means her love and her physical love as well. And so she's saying, it's mine to give. Don't start telling me what I should do with my body. How many times do you think this kind of scenario has been worked out between families, between dads and daughters over the years, over the centuries in various places? With dads and daughters and brothers looking after their sisters and parents looking after their families and their younger children because they want to protect them and they want to look out for them and they want to make sure that the enemy bloke doesn't come and take away their virginity or spoil them or run away with them. And here, it's a very sort of very common, popular type of scenario that you can imagine happening in any kind of era, in any kind of scenario. So, that's just an example of what we know about the sort of sexuality, about the intensity, about the opposition to this love which was being guarded and protected by this couple. And so whilst the Song of Songs is principally an ancient love poem, it also subtly points to something else, both in terms of theology but also relevance for our Christian life. And that is seen really in the sheer physicality of the book and the references to garden and to creation. And the female form and the man's form are compared to all sorts of amazing horticultural creation imagery. And what I want you to do for just a couple of minutes, and I'm going to give you some passages. So perhaps just your little group over there, so that's you three, I want you to look out for and try and write down and name all the references to creation in these particular passages. So if you look in chapter 4, okay, you guys at the back there, you do chapter 5, could you? And perhaps you, let's have a look. You lot there, do chapter 7 and you do chapter 2, please. Or you can join any groups. All I want you to do is try and, you may want to write them down, any references to any form of creation. You've got 2 minutes. Okay, then let's come back. Let's start with the little group over in the corner there, Rich and Christine and Francoise. We may have repetition here because there's a lot of repetition. But let's see how many we can get. So how many have you got? At least 22. Right, name some. Go on, so are they? Doves, sheep, pomegranate, fawns, lilies, myrrh, mountains. Okay, we'll go over there. Okay, what about this group here? Sorry, what else you got? Cinnamon, yeah, well, you've got 26. Okay, do you want to name some that hasn't been named already? Foxes. Little foxes. Okay, what else? Come on, you'd had 26, didn't you? Linnies and fawns, yeah, we've got those.
Mountains.
Forests. Vineyards, gazelles.
Winter.
So
rugged
hills, yes. Fig trees, yes.
Doves.
Fig trees. Okay, what about the back there, guys? What have you got? You got lots. Go on and name them some, Dylan. Shout it out.
Fruit.
Yeah. Lots of pomegranates and fawns and gazelles. Yes, fertility, yes, and they're an aphrodisiac as well. Yes.
Milk, honeycomb.
Honeycomb, yeah, crunchy bars, Mars bars, Twixes, all those things. What about you guys over there? Have you got anything else? Wine, yeah. Gold. Yes, there's a lot there as well. So you think about the sheer intensity of the physicality of this book, the whole idea that it's comparing the physical love, the sexual love, the intensity, the joy, the celebration of the female and the male form, but somehow connecting it with creation, somehow bringing together this covenant love with creation. Lilies, crocuses, palm trees, pomegranates, grapes, wild flowers. Remember what we talked about a few weeks ago. The garden and the land seems to be the setting for the blossoming of love. And we've seen already how land plays an important part in Jesus' teaching. But here, this is where the garden and the land and the vineyards are the place where love grows and blossoms and where desire is satisfied. Remember in chapter 7, the female, the beloved says, let us go and spend the night in the villages. But of course, the villages was just the way in which the translators couldn't bring themselves to talk about going into the wild flowers. And the wild flowers was a euphemism for going into the wild flowers to have sex. And let us spend the night in the villages. It's really, let's go and, you know, have a romp in the wild flowers. I don't know whether there's any wildflowers in your allotment, Lorna, is there? No. She spends a lot of time on the allotment. In fact, a few weeks ago, she was looking at a couple of some books on an allotment shed. I wasn't that interested. Perhaps I might be a little bit more interested in the future. But anyway, let's go and spend the night in the allotment. She hasn't said that yet, but I'm still waiting for it. So the sheer physicality of creation, it is quite overwhelming. And so this song seems to be bursting with a joyful celebration of the lovers' physical bodies, but also their goodness and beauty, which points to the goodness and beauty of creation. And by connecting their love with gardens and streams and mountains and perfume and spices and oil and wine and pomegranates and doves and fawns, the song becomes a rich and exuberant celebration of the goodness and the beauty of creation itself, and all in all its colour and form and design and diversity. And as the lovers connect this covenant love, and they connect with each other verbally, sexually, physically, emotionally, in touch and taste and smell, there is a sort of real sensual joy and celebration about their love, which is mirrored in creation. And you get the feeling that something sacred is going on here in this relationship by connecting their covenant love with their engagement with creation and garden and land. And so in some ways, when we covenant with God, and that's what part of a, you know, being a disciple of Jesus is about, we covenant with God, we're in a relationship with him, a permanent exclusive relationship, the song becomes for us a sort of joyful, exuberant affirmation of the sacredness of engaging with creation, the sacredness of the sensory fullness of engaging with creation. And so that means when we eat some food, when we cook a meal, when we bake some cakes, when we work on the allotment, when we listen to a piece of music, when we read a great novel, when we fix the plumbing, when we hug a friend, when we watch a film, when we play football, although there was nothing sacred about the way that we played football yesterday, believe me, as Vince would have seen, you get the sense in all of this that God is enjoying the moments when his people are enjoying creation. All the things that we do in life, the touch and the taste and the smell, as disciples, as covenant people that should get it even more than anybody else, there is a rich exuberance and celebration about enjoying these very normal, everyday things. And there is something even sacred about those doing those things when we're covenanting with God. And so as we consider what this means for us as disciples, we've also got to consider not only the celebration of desire and fulfillment in these people's, in these lovers' relationship, and also the way in which reflects our desire and fulfillment to enjoy the whole of creation, but also it points to the wider significance of Israel's relationship with God and their own enjoyment of him and that relationship and that covenant. We've talked a little bit about vineyard, but vineyard actually is a Bible metaphor for the nation of Israel itself. Isaiah 5 and verse 1 says, "I will sing for love of the one I love, a song about his vineyard. My loved one has a vineyard on a fertile hillside." It is a vineyard. God's vineyard is actually the nation of Israel. And I think garden actually is quite a good metaphor for us to look at sometime in terms of this whole series, because you've got garden, Eden, you've got Garden of Gethsemane, you've got the garden in the resurrection. You've got actually the pivotal moments of creation and new creation there in the Bible metaphor of garden, but we haven't got time to look at that. But another thing which connects us with the whole Israel story is the references to Lebanon. Now, some of you are going to go to Lebanon, and I don't want you to try and work out some of this stuff while you're in Lebanon, okay? But Lebanon here is referenced 7 times in the book, so it's quite significant. And so for Lebanon to be recognised as a place, it may have been the setting for their lover's relationship, but also for Israel, the mention of Lebanon is very important because it brings to mind the temple in Jerusalem. You may not know this, but David, who built the temple, he brought loads and loads of, in bulk, cedars from Lebanon to build the temple. And so when they hear of Lebanon and the cedars of Lebanon, it is a code word for God's dwelling place in the temple in Jerusalem. And so Lebanon is not only the setting of this love, but also it points to Israel's encounter with God in Jerusalem's temple. Isaiah 60 and verse 13 says, "The glory of Lebanon will come to you, the juniper, the fir, the cypress together, to adorn my sanctuary, and I will glorify the place for my feet." So there's a direct connection between Lebanon, expressed in the song here, and Lebanon as a focus of encounter with God. And so perhaps subtly and tentatively, and this is where we've been cautious about how we apply this, we are pointed towards the significance of Israel's encounter with God and how we encounter with God in the flourishing nature of fertile relationships. And we know, as we've said already, we've talked a little bit this morning about the nature of seed and growth in springtime. But we know that in terms of relationships, relationships need work and they need watering and they need tendering. And the church should be the place where relationships grow and flourish and are fertile. It should be the most fertile setting in all of the world for relationships to grow. And it should be the place where we plant seeds of authentic relationships, and to enable these relationships then, when we are dispersed in the world, to develop relationships with people that don't know God, with friends, with neighbours, with community people, with work colleagues. Because we know what it means to live a life of fruitful, fertile, flourishing, authentic relationships. Because the church is the place where they should sprout up and grow and be evident. And so in doing that, then we are dispersed to nurture other types of relationships as well. And so this intimate, passionate relationship does challenge us about the nature of our relationship with God. When I see the intensity of their relationship, when we read all these words and these metaphors connecting with creation, the sacredness of their relationship, the bond, the exclusive nature of it, their desire for each other, their praise of each other, I think to myself, well, if somehow, subtly, this is pointing Israel to how they should worship and be in encountering God, what does it say about my relationship with God and how we encounter God? So if I was to ask you, how do you encounter God? Well, I've been reflecting this a little bit about my own life and thinking, well, my relationship with God is quite cerebral. That means it's based on sort of knowledge and information. I get a kick out of reading stuff and understanding the Bible deeper and in all its richness. And I have a sort of a very rational, linear mind. And so my worship is not so demonstrative as others. My encounter with God is based around service and action and doing. That's how I feel as if I connect with God. I encounter with God in doing stuff. And yet also, I'm quite emotional. I'm quite demonstrative, especially when it comes to football and watching Leeds. And that's the irrationality of my relationship, because watching Leeds and playing football is sometimes irrational and without logic, certainly, when you know the story of Leeds United. And so you've got to consider ourselves, and I reflected, how does this expose the contradictions and the inconsistencies of how I relate to other people, how I relate to the things that I get a real kick out of, like football and music and other things, and then my relationship with God is so sort of information, knowledge, orderly, linear, tight, rational. It leads me to think a little bit about our left and our right brain functioning. I've got a picture here which I'll come to show you, because we know that scientists have for a while understood the different brain functionings of the left and the right sides of the brain. The left being more based on logic and detail orientated and facts and words and language and maths and science and things that you comprehend and pattern and perception, and it's analytical and it's sequential and it's orderly. But the right side of the brain is where you get art and music and feeling and big picture and imagination and creativity and philosophy and religion and belief. And there is a spatial, spiritual perception to that right side of the brain. Now, you can actually divide the brain up into these very physical parts. But if you consider the analytical and the creative side to the brain, and there isn't, you know, the brain is one whole, so it's not exactly just two separate parts. You're waving at me.
Yeah, you should say that the right controls the left and the left controls the right.
Yeah, thank you. I'll come to that, but now you said it, that's fine. Yes, yeah, we'll come to it. She's a nurse, she always likes butting in to correct me, that's fine. So we know that the brain is a whole, but there are certain dominant elements of it in our different personalities and our different DNA and our different differences as people. And there are sometimes, I think, this is a right-side-brained book, the Song of Songs. because it's so flirtatious and playful and imaginative and creative. And yet so much of my faith is analytical and neat and orderly and information and knowledge and rational. And sometimes I feel as if I should be more demonstrative and encounter God in a different way. And it does stretch us. It does think, well, we are all different, of course. We are different in our personalities and our background and our brain functioning. But at the same time, I think the book does challenge us to think about how we can move out of our comfort zones of how we encounter God. Stretch us a little bit in terms of our senses and in terms of our natural brain functionings and our personality types to perhaps a deeper expression and encounter with God. Because after all, the gospel is the greatest love story of wild, risky, costly, passionate love. All the stuff which is sort of right-brained. And yet so much of the Christian faith and church is orderly and structural and analytical and mind-orientated. And I love the mind. I love grappling with theology, and I love grappling with the relevance of the Bible to today and all that kind of stuff. You know that, and we've been on a story together in a whole load of these things. But sometimes I think there is so much more to our encounter with God and our spirituality that needs to be encountered and experienced. And when we see these lovers experience each other, and if some way, tentatively, that is a mirror or a window into how we can encounter God, then it perhaps leads us possibly to a different place. And that's why in our worship over the last few years, on a Sunday, we've tried to use different forms. You know, getting people up and using things which aren't based on words, because not all of us learn and encounter God with words. We like art and form and music and dance and expression. And that's why participation and using doing stuff and craft and creativity is a way in which people encounter God and each other, and not just listening to someone imparting information or reading a book. And that's why there should be a holistic creativity about the way in which we express ourselves in our personal life with God, but also in our corporate life as a church together. Just a couple more things as we finish. So as we consider our worship for a moment, much of our worship of God is based rightfully on our acknowledgement and thankfulness of what God has done for us and his love, his mercy, his generosity. But this song, this leads us to a new type of focus and a new type of celebration, because the lovers, if you read it, they don't actually talk much about what the other person has done for them. They just praise them for their beauty and their goodness and their form. And they conjure up all these different images about who they are as a person. And so is it possible to celebrate and affirm and encounter God beyond the benefits and the blessings, and to simply delight in who he is? It's very hard, actually, as a discipline. If you are praying, you are very tempted to drift into thankfulness and gratefulness. Now, believe me, thankfulness and gratefulness are a key component of our life as Christian disciples. They are an essential foundation to that as well. But in terms of our encounter with God and take us to a different place, which this song points to in terms of human relationships, then I tried to do this the other day, and I ended up actually falling asleep, but just for a brief moment. But the fact is, it is quite hard to actually praise somebody purely for who they are and not what they've done for you. Because it's quite embarrassing, it's quite cringy. It's quite sort of, when we had to do this for Lanva, we had Lanva and Sarah, and some of you know, he organised a birthday party in celebration of Sarah. And he got everybody up, and he sat her in a seat, and we all had to say lovely things about her. And it was astonishingly and excruciatingly embarrassing. Well, I found it very embarrassing as well. I'm sure Sarah did as well.
We had to do it again, Lambert.
Oh, really? Yes. I'm glad. God is affirming, yes, okay. But it was very hard because, you know, you say you do this and you do that, but the really hard part is describing somebody just purely for who they are. And actually, when we come to relate to God, it's actually very hard to do that. It's easier to do that when we talk about Jesus, because we have a sort of mental, biblical picture of Jesus, which is sometimes easier in our minds and our imagination to conjure up. So, somehow I think this song takes us to places in terms of our relationship with God that challenges us. And perhaps when we seek to affirm God and delight in him and who he is, there is something that booms back to us in terms of God's voice for us, in terms of affirmation. Because perhaps God's voice back to us in that moment of encounter says to us his love for us is not about what we do, it's not about what we're good at, it's not about our gifts, it's simply God's delight in who we are. Now that is astonishing, to think actually the actions, the service, all the good things that we do for God and for this world and for each other, God actually just purely and simply and plainly delights in who we are as people. And perhaps this is a two-way recognition of this relationship. And so as we finish, I just want to read for the moment the last couple of verses in chapter 8 to see how this song finishes. So if you want to turn to that, because we've looked at some of these, but if you look at the last two verses, the lover says, "You who dwell in the gardens with friends in attendance, let me hear your voice." And then the beloved says, "Come away, my lover, and be like a gazelle or like a young stag on the spice-laden mountains." And then it ends. The book just finishes just like that. It's sort of like an abrupt ending. You're thinking, what happened to them? Did they get married? Did they fulfill their desires? Did the voices, the aggressive voices, win in the end, so they had to be separate? Did they no longer see each other anymore? We just don't know what happened to them. And in some ways, the ending of the book on this uncertain note, and the ambiguity of what happened to the lovers, and their possible anticipation of a next meeting, but we don't know where or how or what happened, there is something about the ending of it that signifies the whole book. The whole book of longing and searching and finding momentarily, but then disappearing again. The sense that there is a struggle for the love, there is longing and desire, but there's also disappointment in the midst of the hopefulness that they would meet, that they would consummate their love, that their desires would be satisfied. But somehow then they disappear and they don't see each other again. And if somehow we can point this relationship to Israel's encounter with God and our encounter with God, this longing and this anticipation for God and for a better world is part and parcel of the Christian faith. It's part and parcel of an authentic faith. The longing which is never fully realised will never fully be satisfied or fulfilled. And the art of the authentic Christian life, the authentic spiritual life, is living with longing, is living with an eager anticipation in the midst of disappointment, and straining for a connection with God in this world, and hopefulness of a new creation is coming and will come. And we long and we strain for this, and this is part and parcel. In the midst of uncertainty and ambiguity and defeat and disappointment, there is all this ambiguity, but that's authentic Christian life, struggling in the midst of that to find his presence, to ask, "Where are you, God? I can't find you. I can't feel you." And perhaps my mind is the only place I can recover my encounter with God sometimes, when I don't feel that emotional, passionate encounter. And sometimes we need to function both in terms of brain, left and right, when we have to assert our faith in the midst of doubt and disappointment and ambiguity and uncertainty. And so we are called, like the lovers, to a passionate faithful, persistent relationship with God. And to imitate their haste, their desire for each other, to imitate their desire in the midst of struggle and disappointment and uncertainty, and to hope and to long for connection and fulfillment and longing and new creation. And essentially, that is what the Christian life is. That's what we're called to do and to be in terms of working this out in the world. Let's pray.